This is Norfolk Works, and I'm Hazel Kahn. My guest today is environmental architect and water activist Glynis Berry. Glynis, you and I have frequented several of the same art and political and environmental gatherings over the years, but when your reports set off alarms all over the North Fork, I couldn't wait to ask you for an interview. So, Glynis, to start off our conversation, could you just give us a bit of your backstory? And welcome to North Fork Works.
I'm from New England originally. I'm living in Orient, New York. I came to architecture late. I tend to be interested in infrastructure and environmental issues, as well as issues related to community. And I actually spent 11 years with the New York City Department of Transportation, where I started their pedestrian and traffic calming program. Hmm. I tend to like thinking about how we live and use our environment. We were one of the early firms that joined the U.S. Green Building Council, the LEED program, where when you build, you try and be as sustainable as possible in many different disciplines.
You said you came to architecture late. Were you trained in something else before that?
I studied English and art, and I worked in museums.
And now you're working outside,
Yes. Basically.
What I also know is that you started Peconic Green Growth.
Correct.
Can you talk about that?
It was a combination of factors. We saw the environmentalists almost not wanting any humans to enter their realm to preserve nature almost intact. And we also saw the development of communities where they weren't considering the environment enough. We were very interested in the intersection of those two. And how can you make the integration better? And two things kind of sparked us starting the nonprofit. One was we used to have art exhibitions in our office, and one was Called to Action, Environmental Restoration by Artists, that was curated by Lillian Ball. And when we worked together on that, I was impressed with trying to combine cultural and environmental issues with and involve it in the thought process. And then simultaneously, I organized a one-day symposium on wastewater. And the reason was it seemed to be the controlling factor on how you build communities.
What exactly is wastewater?
Basically, the water that exits your house. So it includes water from your toilet and showers and sink and washing machine. And what I discovered was that locally, we were concerned about treating it for drinking water standards, but not for environmental conditions, which are much more sensitive. When I learned that, I started focusing on...
Your eyes lit up and you said, So what were they not looking at?
Well, for instance, one of the factors everybody considers is how much nitrogen is there, because if you have too much nitrogen, you get algal blooms in the surface waters. And the limit for drinking water is 10 milligrams per liter, but for the bays, it's 0.5 milligrams per liter. So you're talking about a sensitivity that's 20 times that of drinking water.
So the bays are much more sensitive than
Yes. Humans,
really? Mm. Okay, so you then became concerned with wastewater. You started to understand
Yes. That.
Then what did you do?
We then did a study to identify a methodology to identify the priorities for where you need to do something to enhance the treatment of your wastewater. And from that, we started to join other groups. There are a number of different groups that have different kinds of expertise that contributed to influencing the county to take another look at this. The town of Southold decided to create a committee to look into water conservation, and they asked me to be an advisor to the group. And Peconic Green Growth applied for a grant with the Long Island Community Foundation. They funded it, and we spent the last year foiling water use records and analyzing them. The town of Southold is unusual in that roughly half the populace uses on-site wells and half is connected to public water. The on-site wells are the private wells. The public wells are Suffolk County Water Authority.
but there's still wells. When people say we get public water.
That's a good point. Everybody is actually accessing the water in our aquifers, which are underground reservoirs of fresh water. The public water actually is taking water from the same aquifers as the on-site. They actually have 58 wells throughout the town, but they have an infrastructure where they're piping it to the individual homes and properties.
Okay, so when you buy town water,
it's coming from the same place. Now, it's a little more complicated in Southold because we're at the end of where the aquifers start breaking down. So we tend to have these individual pockets of deeper fresh water, and we only rely on the very top aquifer because below us, the water is salty. So we're basically bubbles of fresh water floating on salt water.
Really?
Yeah. So we're more fragile than other places, because in other places they can drill deeper and access fresh water in deeper aquifers.
And why can't we? Because
they're saline. We have one aquifer in addition to the upper aquifer, but it's saline under us.
Is there anything between the fresh and the saline?
It varies in the location. Sometimes it's literally sitting on salt water, and sometimes there might be a layer of soil that's isolating it.
Is wastewater a conservation issue too?
The wastewater has two aspects to it. One is the level of pollution, and the other is, do we have opportunities of reusing or disposing of it in a more benign way? So they're really two separate issues, but they both affect the health of our source of drinking water and the health of the bays. They're separate topics, separate research, but in fact, they do interrelate. But this latest report is focused on conservation.
Have we ever had to conserve water here on the East End?
I'm not sure. I think that the formation of this committee was made because we were starting to get warnings of difficulty in the provision of enough water to meet peak demand when everybody wants water at the same time. And also, we are liable to droughts. So during a period of drought, we may not be as resilient. The Suffolk County Water Authority actually did a presentation to the town. They were talking about the difficulty of providing water during the summer, during the early morning hours. Everybody who had sprinkler systems, they were set to all come on basically at the same time of day. So there would be this incredible demand all at once. So that causes the Water Authority to have to build more infrastructure, storage tanks, more wells to meet that demand that's just for an hour or so. It increased the costs of drinking water, and it also threatens the viability of our aquifers because when you pump all at once, you're more likely to pull in salt and contaminate your fresh water.
And then when the peak demand stops, does the salt water recedes?
Not necessarily. And this is part of the problem because on the North Fork, we are more susceptible because we are these floating bubbles. So when you pull them in, the salt water comes around. So it actually shrinks the freshwater supply. And because the freshwater is lighter, it may not recover as well. So those peaks, those extreme peaks, can actually damage your aquifer.
So you know that, and the town knows that, the Water Authority knows that. All they did is they tried to meet the demand. They didn't feel that it was, then therefore the supply should be curbed in some way.
They did build storage tanks so that they could pump during the off-peak, so they would have more water ready for the peak delivery. Actually, the DEC, the New York Department of Environmental Conservation, actually asked all the suppliers of public water on Long Island to reduce their peak demands by 15%. And in response to that, the Suffolk County Water Authority does have a very, I consider it a weak incentive program.
What is it?
$50 for moisture sensors for irrigation systems and $10 for shower heads or aerators, with a limit of $50 per customer credit on your bill.
People like you, experts and so on, see this problem, and it's so difficult to persuade all the people who could solve the problem.
Well, I think the problem here is it's not visceral. You know,
not visceral.
Yes. We don't sense that there's a shortage of water because we have a lush environment. And this year particularly, we got quite a bit of rain. So you feel like everything's fine. And over history, they've had access to water. So there's not a sense of crisis. But things are changing. Uses are becoming more intense. In our study, we found that a rough correlation between the value of a home and how much water it used. So we are a tourist industry. Tourist industries tend to use more water. Just serving people, you know, and also the elderly. We have a high senior population and they use more water. We are a farming community, so we need water for the crops. That's a priority to protect.
Is that all then manifested, reflected in this peak demand?
Well, there are two kinds of peaks. One is seasonal and one is daily. The one we talked about where all the sprinklers turn on at the same time as the daily peak. And another is seasonal. In July, we use 4.7 times the amount of water we use in February. Summer is when we have less rainfall, when everybody's using it. So that stresses your aquifer. It pulls it in, and then it needs to recover. I found a 1964 report, which I thought was great. It recommended that we should never use more than 30% of the rainwater that gets recharged into the ground. And that would give you some flexibility to deal with those fluctuations. I found another presentation that was more recent in 2011 that predicted that if we didn't lower those peak demands, we would lose 40 feet of depth to the aquifer by 2030.
That's a permanent loss of 40 feet.
A permanent loss.
And what was 40 feet is how much of the I have no idea how deep aquifers are.
If it's fresh water sort of floating on salt water, there's a rule of thumb that for every 1 foot above sea level, there will be 40 feet below you. And so by looking at a contour map of groundwater, you can usually figure the rough estimate of how much water is in a location. And what was alarming for me, when we were doing the report, we were looking at the 2010 contour maps of groundwater that the U.S. Geological Survey puts out. In most of our area, we had 5-foot contours.
5 foot above sea level?
Right. Mm-hmm. So that would indicate 200-foot depth. And then after I finished the report, I saw a map for 2016, which is the same date of our data, and 5-foot contours had disappeared from Orient, East Marion, Greenport, and there had been a very small 10-foot contour in Cutchogue, and that disappeared. The water was lower, and you would almost expect the opposite with climate change because you would expect it to rise. I think we're already seeing the impacts. I calculated how much water they were predicting for 2030. It looked to me like we were already using 24% more water than was predicted for 2030. So we were already using water at a rate that would have a very negative impact on our resource.
Yeah, there's this other measure.
Global footprint. They calculate the resources of the Earth and how much we consume. And then they identify the date where we've used up that year's worth of resources.
Glynis Berry's talking about water conservation on the East End. This is North Fork Works on WPKN Radio. So there is, among people who think about these things, there is very much this feeling of diminishing resources. Well, that's what sustainability is about, right?
Right.
Is that we're using more than we should.
Yes.
And it's not being replenished.
Right. Water is one of those magic things that can be replenished. So there's the same amount of water on Earth. It's just what form is it and where it is in the water cycle. Locally, we have conditions that do limit the availability of fresh water. So we are experiencing that on the North Fork, and conservation would help us to use that available water in a manner that it continues to be sustainable. Within that 30% of recharge, and we really understand those limits and do our planning so that we consume water within those limits, then we should be sustainable. If we don't, we really risk those aquifers.
Talk about what recharge and what discharging means.
Okay, we're trying to see how much water gets down into the groundwater, into those aquifers that we use for fresh water. Basically, when the rain comes down, not all the rain makes it to the aquifer. Some of it is used by plants, some of it is evaporated, so that's called evapotranspiration, and some of it is runoff. If we have too many impervious surfaces, it will run off the site.
Because it can't get absorbed.
It can't be absorbed. Right.
Blacktop is one of those, and roads is
right.
One of those things.
So those are the reduce the amount of water that gets recharged into the aquifer.
So how do you know all this stuff?
I'm a novice. I just started reading and read reports. And
because, I mean, now you're considered an expert. No, I mean, you are. Yeah. I mean, your name is associated with water studies certainly on the East End, on the North Fork.
Well, that's scary because I'm not an expert, but I'm a planner. And what I do is I ask questions that will inform decision making. And I think that's what we offer because I want to know how much water is enough. How much should we be using? And that's probably what I have to offer to the discussion.
Okay. So what you have made clear is that we need to be watching how much water we're using. That
yes.
We're using too much water.
Right.
Are you the first person who said that or who is able to substantiate that statement?
I don't know if I'm the first one. I mean,
maybe the loudest.
Maybe there were those two reports that I mentioned back in 1964, and then that 2011. I don't know why that didn't ring alarm bells.
Are they ringing now, the alarm bells?
I believe so.
Do credit yourself for that. I mean, I'll credit you if you don't want to credit yourself. But in your work, people have listened to you.
Yes.
The decision makers are listening to you.
Yes.
I don't feel we've talked enough about your report.
One thing that I discovered is that our average household use was 2.4 times the national average during the summer months, and that was 559 gallons per day. The median was only 247 gallons per day. So there's a lot of variance, and 39% of the households were using more than 150% of the national average. This points to social injustice issues also because the water rates are even and you have a smaller segment of society using more water, and that increased the cost of delivery, and it's also threatening the sustainability of our source. So if we don't do something, we may end up with unusable aquifers, and everybody will have to join public water, and it will have to be pumped from much further away.
Is there talk about charging people more after they use a certain amount?
We are going to advocate for that. Also, any differential should be dedicated to a pot of money for incentives for conservation. There are both indoor and outdoor conservation irrigation systems. There are things called smart controllers or moisture sensors that will stop you wasting water. The best way is to not irrigate or to design things like rain gardens, use native plantings. There have been actually some successful programs out west that have actually paid people to pull out their lawns. Indoors, one of the most effective ways of reducing your usage is to use a low-flow toilet. And there are some now that only use 0.8 gallons per flush. And that is a consistent, reliable reduction of water use. Other things are shower heads and faucet aerators.
Do you think people would be persuaded to change out their current devices like that, or would they have to be incentivized to do it?
I think people need incentives, and this is proven by a lot of communities in the West where they have actually successfully reduced water use by like 45% through incentive programs. If that doesn't meet your goal, then look at regulation. Ultimately, if you don't get there, you're going to have water budget and possibly even restricting use. But I don't think it will go there. I think you can get where we need to be through incentive programs. And education, awareness, and incentive programs, we really need oversight to avoid abuses. Recently, the town of Shelter Island has put restrictions on the use of their aquifers for irrigation or the filling of swimming pools. So the water has to be trucked in from another location. And guess where those trucks are filling up? Here.
Oh, here on our North Fork?
Yes. They're filling up where we have probably an even more fragile system because we're very narrow and we have higher demands. They're pulling that water and delivering it elsewhere.
They pay for it, or they just...
No, because it's not being controlled.
But if you know that, does the town know that?
They're just discovering it. The oversight, who owns the water, who can control the water, and how do you do that? And how do you work with multiple jurisdictions and multiple users to get a handle on how you avoid misuse?
How do you persuade people that actually there's just not going to be enough water? It's one thing to describe the problem. It's another thing to make it personal.
I think we have to change the culture of what we value in a landscape. And there are a number of different groups that are starting to work on this. So putting more value on landscapes that are more natural and getting away from this green carpet that's perfect, I think will go a long way to making people value water and valuing the environment they chose to live in. I mean, most people who chose to live here chose it because they're valuing this natural environment.
Changing the culture is starting with what is important to you. People think of the environment as not really theirs. Mm-hmm. They think of their piece of land as theirs. But the environment kind of, there's big gaps there that need to be closed.
Right. That's true. But we have succeeded here. The eastern towns had a preservation fund to purchase development rights of land. And we're actually very successful at preserving farmland and open space. Now they have to do the same thing for these unseen bodies of water that are under their feet. And I think it means taking ownership that they need to protect it. Because if they don't, it will get destroyed.
Yeah, I think you need to talk in those terms.
Yeah.
Don't count on a thing like this if you continue doing what you're doing.
Right.
It's not the same as open space. I understand what you're saying, but...
I think maybe the difference is it's somebody else's job to protect the aquifer, and maybe everybody in the community needs to step up and make sure it's protected.
Yeah, and because it's water and it's fluid by mm-hmm. definition, because this aquifer is, you know, when you talk about this one big aquifer, everybody's sort of tapping into it. It's a difficult thing to understand, to internalize.
Yes, absolutely.
And it'd be very interesting, actually, and I might suggest to you that it's the psychology of it, really.
Right.
I mean, I'd be happy to think about something like that with you.
That would be terrific.
Yeah, and it's a very interesting problem, but it's also a serious problem. One thing we haven't covered is if you could tell people just your website is.
The full report can be found on our website, pecconicgreengrowth.org, under the resource tab. Water consumption in the town of Southold. It's probably going to be the issue of the rest of this century. Who has access to it where? We're already seeing parts of the world that are totally changing. People are having to move. Livelihoods are being lost. If everybody had to go on public water locally, the water becomes salty and they can't even irrigate the fields. It might kill farming. And then you start getting unrest, because if the private sector ends up controlling the resource, it becomes more expensive. Again, it's a matter of social equity So water no longer becomes a right, it becomes a commodity. And that control of the commodity can lead to all sorts of disasters.
It really disrupts society. Right. Yeah. So right now, water is considered public and a right.
Right.
The ownership is public.
Actually, no. Here it's not. That's the thing that's a little scary, is what we call public water is actually controlled by a public benefit corporation. So they do have to get approval for some things, but it is a corporate mentality of increasing customer base and increasing sales.
Really? Suffolk County Water Authority?
Mm-hmm. And there have been areas where the water went private and then municipalities took it over again and made it public. So I think water is going to be a public-private issue, whether it should be nonprofit, whether there should be profit-taking. And there was just an article in the New York Times, I think within the past month or so, about a community in Arizona. A corporation came in that dug deeper wells and basically destroyed everybody's wells. It lowered the groundwater below everybody's wells. And some people ended up abandoning their properties.
This has just now happened?
Yes.
In Arizona?
Yes.
It should almost be like a central thing, water, if you have to ship it to places where it's not.
Yes and no, because who do they destroy and who do they protect?
Mm.
So it needs everybody at the table. You have to protect. There are some river regulations, and part of that river flow needs to support the environment. It's not just for human consumption. You really need to look at the whole picture.
I suddenly thought of people who, you know, deliberately leave some fruit on the tree for the birds.
Right, right.
It's the same mentality.
It's the same mentality.
So what is the philosophy here that we're ending up with?
One, I think conservation is the number one thing we have to do for water.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And we also need to think in terms of a water budget that protects a range of uses and the environment so that we are sustainable. We don't want to be in a position where we're going to be relying on water that is sourced far away when we're a rural community that should be supporting itself.
Got to change the way people think about it. Are you optimistic?
Yeah, I've seen communities that have been very successful in reducing their water use. Phoenix, Las Vegas, Santa Fe, you know, there are a number of communities that have drastically changed their water consumption.
And was it because they saw the end of their water? I mean,
yes,
a crisis.
It was a real crisis.
So rather than try and, you know, make people just think differently, maybe crisis is where change actually happens.
But unfortunately, our environment is going to be more difficult to recover because of the nature of our aquifer. You know, it's not a lake that will fill up. It is this floating bubble. So we really need to protect it even more because it's our only source of water.
And you think the people in the town have changed?
I think they're listening. The town just applied for a grant to lead by example, to upgrade their plumbing fixtures, to introduce a rain garden, and to put meters on their on-site wells. A grant to help educate the residents and to upgrade the town facilities in terms of water conservation.
Well, thank you very much, Glynis Berry. I'm really glad we had this conversation. I look forward to maybe, you know, working with you on something.
That would be fabulous.
More psychological. Thank you very much again, Glynis.
Thank you for being interested in the topic.
Well, I think I have to be. The alarm factor has worked on me.
Thank you.
You heard Glynis Berry talking about water conservation on the East End of Long Island. You can hear North Fork Works on the first Wednesday of every month at 7:30 p.m. All North Fork Works programs are available on hazelcarlin.com and produced by Tony Ernst.